This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. This is a spotlight on high volume, inexpensive red wines. This spotlight is part of our Level 3 podcast, and the big difference between WST Level 2 and WST Level 3 is that at Level 2, you need to know different winemaking techniques, oak barrels, malolactic conversion. But at Level 3, you need to understand how to use those different winemaking techniques to create different styles of wines. In fact, Chapter 8, White and Sweet Winemaking, and Chapter 9, Red Rosé Winemaking, identify six different wine styles and the techniques used to make them. So in this particular spotlight, we're going to take high volume, inexpensive red wines. We will have a look at the wine making techniques, but I also want to expand it to look at the business, the climatic conditions that make these wines possible, wine styles, obviously the winemaking options, and also look at a couple of different regions that produce these styles of wines and look at what problems or advantages they have in those regions. In effect, we're going to pull information from all over the WST Level 3 syllabus and expand and explain high volume, inexpensive red wines. The other styles that we will look at over time include premium red wines, aromatic white wines, less aromatic whites, sweet wines, and rosé wines. But as I said, we're going to be looking at high volume red wines. Before we do that, let's start off with the definition. What is high volume, inexpensive red wines? And as I said, they're a generic category that often follow certain winemaking principles. And they're defined in the WST Level 3 book, Chapter 9, Red and Rosé Winemaking. We're going to go beyond just that section and look at regions, climates, etc. that these wines are made. Let's start off, though, by looking at the market. And high-volume, inexpensive red wines are wines obviously made and sold in high volumes. Sounds a bit obvious. And because they're made in high volumes, the types of people who produce them tend to be things like co-ops and large merchants. They're much more likely to make the style of wine than, say, an estate. Remember, the definition of an estate is a producer who grows their own grapes. In France, you might see it on the label saying something like château or domaine. They generally mean that that means that the château or the producer has grown their own grapes and made that wine. In many countries, the word estate is used. Medium to larger estates may make high volume, inexpensive wine. However, the volume of the wine is usually too large for the estates to produce their own grapes themselves, and often they use contract growers to grow some of the grapes. If they're using a contract grower, then technically that makes them a merchant rather than an estate. It's usually co-ops and large merchants who tend to make these styles of wines. Now, a producer of a high-volume, inexpensive red wine may dominate a local market, but it's more likely that it's going to be exported to a number of different countries. And as a result, they often need to deal with the complexities of more than one country with transportation issues, distribution, and retailers all different. Packaging may need to be localized, taxes will vary, each market will have their own market forces, and the high volumes required mean that these organizations often need to be quite large to cope with a large number of markets. So dealing with complex markets, often growers who grow the grapes for them also have a large winery making operation as well, means that it's often the larger co-ops and the big merchants that are good at this. Or if they're a smaller to medium-sized merchant, the size and complexity and hopefully the sales will mean they'll become a more medium to large merchant later on. The style of wine produced, and it's a dirty rule of thumb, but general rule of thumb is that high volume, inexpensive red wines often use winemaking techniques that produce low tannins wines. And that's because to achieve high volume sales, the wines need to be popular to as many people as possible. Sensitive tasters may find high tannins overwhelming for them, and they make up approximately a third of the population. So usually you're trying to find a wine that everybody can enjoy, and as a result, they tend to be lowish tannins, maybe up to medium tannins, but low to medium tannins. Reliable, popular, easy drinking wine at a low cost with good distribution are all key factors to achieve high sales when making a high volume, inexpensive red wine successful. Okay, let's start off with viticulture. And one of the things about making the style of wine is you need to keep your pricing quite low. And to produce wines at a low price, margins and budgets are tight. The ideal climate is a warm, sunny, dry climate with very low climatic risks, such as frost. Often, this is in a warm to hot Mediterranean or continental climate. Now, warmer climates mean that large crops of grapes can be successfully ripened, helping to improve the economies of scale. A dry climate reduces the cost of chemical sprays to protect against grey rot and powdery and downy mildew. A long, dry autumn also allows a longer time for the grapes to ripen, allowing even larger crops. That's because the more grapes on a vine, the longer it takes for sugar levels to build up in those grapes, with all other things being equal. In climates with warm, dry autumns, large crops can take a longer time for the sugars to build up, and this often results in riper flavors in the grapes. So as red wines ripen, they'll often go through a red fruits, black fruits, and then maybe a cooked or baked fruit situation. And quite often these high volume, inexpensive wines, they have huge crop loadings. They take forever for the sugar levels to build up high enough. And as a result, you quite often land up in black fruits and cooked or stewed fruits as well. Wines like this come from all over the place. California, southeastern Australia, south of France, Puglia, Sicily, and even Veneto IGT in the northeast. High volume, inexpensive red wines can be produced in a maritime climate. It's just that there's high spraying costs usually associated with a maritime climate, with it raining all year round and pretty randomly as well. And sometimes you also get reduced volumes, often because it's a more temperate climate, and also because you could get rain during flowering, which will again decrease the volume of grapes that you can pull off. It's also difficult to produce high volume, inexpensive wines in a cool climate. Again, that's because you generally can't produce large crop yields because it's just not warm enough to get the sugars high enough, which means that makes economics a little bit more difficult. So the optimum place is typically a warm to hot climate in a Mediterranean or continental climate. And the biggest risk to many vineyards in these warmer, drier vineyards is drought. So irrigation, where possible, can often be a worthwhile investment. Now, we're going to talk a wee bit about the vineyard. And high-volume, inexpensive red wines often use mechanization and irrigation. In warm, dry climates where drought is a risk, water is often expensive. This means that the water-saving drip irrigation is usually the preferred option over more wasteful sprinklers or flood irrigation. Mechanization is also preferred if possible, because as vineyard sizes get larger, the high capital cost but lower running cost of mechanization outweigh the low capital but high running cost of labor. But the problem with mechanization is it typically requires flattish, trellised vineyards. So warm to hot climate, Mediterranean to continental, so you don't have any rain risk during the season. A risk of drought, which is managed by irrigation and often grown on flat land that's trellised, is the ideal situation. But often, wine regions are a compromise in some way or another. For example, in Spain's La Mancha and Valdepeñas, where it's often both hot and very dry, there's a tension between irrigation and mechanization. For mechanical harvesting, vines need to be trellised. However, in a really dry climate where water is incredibly expensive, irrigation is less of an option. If the soil holds the water well, then a large spacing between vines can help reduce water stress on the vines. The vines can spread out and cover a large area, absorbing water stored in the ground over a large area. But the problem with that is, if you've got vines quite a distance apart, the cost of trellising per vine goes through the roof. So we've got very low density planting. Quite often trellising is no longer an option because of the cost of that. As a result, historically, in places like La Mancha and Valdepeñas, untrellised bush vines were common with low density planting, and this meant that there was less mechanisation and higher labour costs, but it also meant there was much lower water demand. As I said, the perfect vineyards for high volume, inexpensive red wines are grown in warmed, hot, dry conditions. They'd be flat, they'd be trellised to aid mechanisation, and they'd be irrigated with a plentiful supply of water. Not many regions have all those answers ticked, so there's always a little bit of a compromise. Now, not every grape is suitable for a high-volume, inexpensive red wine. Not all grapes thrive in warm, dry, sunny climates, especially when they're produced at high yields. Having grapes with concentrated colour, tannins, and flavours in the grape skins is essential. And international grape varieties such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Syrah/Shiraz, Garnacha/Grenache are all suitable for making fruity wines with deep colour at high yields. Garnacha is probably a little bit of an odd one out in that group because it does produce paler coloured wines, but it is definitely used to make high volume, inexpensive red wines. Now, let's talk about the winemaking a little bit because there's quite a bit in this. As we've said earlier, the type of wine we're trying to make in a high volume, inexpensive red wines are often in a fruity, low tannin styles. Often wineries are trying to make a lot, i.e. high volume, of these inexpensive red wines, so moving the wine through the winery as quickly as possible is an important part of keeping the costs down. To move through the winery quickly, certain options are better than others. For example, filtration is a lot faster than, say, sedimentation, where you're waiting for anything in the wine to fall out, as opposed to running through a filter. Oak chips and staves are much faster over the slower oak barrels. There are still many options that winemakers can take, but speed and cost often preclude many of them from being typically used. In a nutshell, we're looking for the following things. Typically, but not always, but typically the wines follow some sort of protective winemaking that's keeping it away from oxygen. You often find pre-fermentation maceration. Usually the fermentation itself is fermented at a lower temperature and there's very little cap work. And finally, there's often no post-fermentation maceration at all. Let's look at those four different things in a bit more detail. So we'll start off with protective winemaking. To produce a fruity style of wine, protective or anaerobic, that's without oxygen, winemaking is essential. Oxygen tends to erode fruit flavours. It can make the wine more stable for long-term ageing, but we're not looking for that. We're looking for upfront fruit, so we've got to keep oxygen away from the grapes and the wine in the winemaking process. And it starts in the vineyard. Our vines would be machine harvested at night and the cooler parts of the day. The idea is that the cooler the grapes, the slower the oxidation occurs. They'll also get sprinkled with sulfur dioxide, which helps absorb any oxygen that might oxidize the wines. Winery equipment will be designed to keep oxygen away from the grapes and juice, and this includes such things as sealed equipment that is pre-flushed with carbon dioxide or nitrogen. So you want to put the grapes in a tank, you fill up the tank with carbon dioxide first, then you put the grapes in, and then the grapes never got exposed to any oxygen, so protective winemaking. Same with crushers, presses, all that type of thing. You want to keep oxygen away from the wines. So, for example, an open basket press is the last type of press that you'll use because there's a lot of oxygen exposure in that type of press. A closed bladder press, where you inflate a bag on the inside, that whole area can be pre-flushed with carbon dioxide or nitrogen, meaning that the wine can be kept away from oxygen. Once the grape's been crushed, the winemaker can take some readings of it, but typically grapes grown in a warm, dry climate for extended periods on the vine often have low levels of acidity, so it is very common for wineries to adjust the acidity before fermentation by adding tartaric acid. Okay, let's talk about pre-fermentation maceration now. Now, once the grapes have been destemmed, if they're whole bunches, or if they've machine harvested, they won't have any stems, and they've been crushed, the grapes may undergo pre-fermentation maceration. Now, pre-fermentation maceration is where the juice is in contact with the skins, but the temperature is kept very cold so that any yeast doesn't start the alcoholic fermentation, and there's no alcohol there either. Now, alcohol is a solvent for tannins. The less alcohol, the harder it is to extract tannins from the skins. But colour and flavour comes out just from being in contact. You don't need alcohol for that. So usually a pre-fermentation maceration, the object here is to extract colour, it's to extract flavour, but it's not to extract any tannins. And it's a way of producing deeply coloured, flavoursome wines without many tannins. Pre-fermentation maceration. The trouble you have with pre-fermentation maceration is that while it can extract lots of flavour and colour from the skins, the grapes need to be sitting in a tank for a period of time, which is not ideal if you're looking for a high-throughput winery. It's just tank space. More tank space means more cost, so more cost and slower processing time. It may improve the quality of the wine, but it's not possible for the very cheapest of these types of wines. If you're doing a pre-fermentation maceration, fine. If you're not doing one, that's fine as well. The next step, though, is fermentation. And the tank used for fermentation varies from stainless steel, epoxy-lined concrete tanks, and very, very occasionally rotary fermenters, although I really can't see the point of that myself. Fermentation typically occurs using cultured yeasts, and that's because tank variation is really to be minimized. To be honest, complexity is less important than consistency. The cultured yeast, when they're added, and maybe the juice is warmed up a little bit, the fermentation will start. Now, the higher the fermentation temperature, the more you extract tannins and color. But you also lose floral notes in the wine, and you can lose other flavors as well. And it can also impede the development of some fruity aromas. So for this reason, the fermentation often occurs at 22 to 25 degrees Celsius. That's the cooler end of 20 to 32 degrees Celsius, which is your classic red wine fermentation temperature. So you don't want to extract tannins, and you don't want to lose any floral or fruit flavors, and you want to encourage the development of fruit flavors. You need to be down the cooler end of the 20 to 32 degrees Celsius classic red wine fermentation, and 22 to 25 degrees Celsius is where you want to be. In Fahrenheit, that's 72 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, and the typical Fahrenheit temperature range for red wines is 68 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. To control the temperature, and remember, alcoholic fermentation is exothermic. It actually produces heat going through the fermentation. So you actually need to keep the temperature down actively if you want a cool fermentation. So temperature-controlled stainless steel is ideal for this type of thing. It's easier to clean than, say, epoxy-lined concrete tanks, which require more labor. But before the adoption of stainless steel, epoxy-lined concrete tanks were the preferred method for making high-volume, inexpensive red wines. And many traditional wineries and co-ops still use epoxy-lined concrete tanks for their high-volume, inexpensive red wines. But these days, concrete tanks, their unique properties are more in demand for other styles of wines. During fermentation, there's very little cap work going on. A cap forms from a mass of grape skins. As the alcoholic fermentation is going on, CO2 is released. That CO2 rises to the surface, and as it rises, it sort of catches into the skins that are floating in the juice, and those skins get lifted up to the top of the tank. Now, if you're trying to extract lots of colour and tannins from those skins, you need to get that cap back into the juice so that it's in good contact. In a high-volume, inexpensive red wine, we're not trying to make big tannic wines, so you tend not to manipulate the cap. So things like punching down, pumping over, rack and return, all these methods of getting the skins and the cap back into the juice to extract colour, tannins and flavour, less of a priority. Now, as I said earlier, tannin extraction is governed primarily by alcohol and temperature. So often towards the end of the fermentation, as the alcohol is getting to its highest point, wineries opt to lower the fermentation of the juice to reduce the amount of tannins being extracted towards the end of the fermentation. And that helps make lower tannin wines. Now, what I've described is a classic way of making a low tannin, easy drinking, not particularly expensive style of wine. Another way to produce a soft, easy drinking red wine is using carbonic maceration. Now, this method minimizes tannin extraction and makes low tannins wines with bright fruity wine flavors such as kirsch, banana, bubblegum, and a cinnamon-like spice. The problem with it is whole bunches are required, which means an increase in cost with hand harvesting. But that cost isn't so much that inexpensive red wines can't be made that way. If you think of entry-level Beaujolais and some Spanish wines often use whole bunch fermentation to make wines that are a lot softer and more approachable from some grapes like Monastrell, which can produce high tannic wines. Now, I'm not going to go into carbonic maceration in a big way. We've got a whole spotlight on carbonic maceration, and I strongly recommend you listen to that at some point. After the alcoholic fermentation is finished, quite often for other styles of wine, post-fermentation maceration occurs. But as I said earlier, after alcoholic fermentation, alcohol levels are high, temperatures tend to be a little bit high as well, which is the perfect conditions to extract tannins. And in a high-volume, inexpensive red wine, this is undesirable. Not only does it make winemaking more tannic, which is undesirable, it also holds up tank space, which, as we've said, is a premium on these high-throughput wineries. So post-fermentation maceration, leaving the juice in contact with the finished wine to extract more colour, tannins, and flavour is not necessarily the thing to do. What will be required is some sort of pressing and filtering, because you've just finished fermentation, you've got loads of skins mixed in with the wine, so first thing you've got to do is start clearing that out. And after fermentation, the free-run juice will be racked off the skins to a new tank, while the remaining skins will be loaded into a press, ideally in an oxygen-free environment. When you come to pressing the juice, the higher the press pressure, the greater the colour and tannins are extracted. And wineries will set aside these different press fractions as blending options to make sure they get the wine that they want. After racking off the free-run juice and pressing the wine, you'll typically leave the juice to stand for several hours to allow any skin fragments or pips or dead yeast cells. This is called gross lees, and it'll take a while for that to fall out of suspension in the wine, and waiting for it to come out is known as sedimentation. Gross lees only takes a couple of hours for it to come out, but if you're using a very high throughput winery and time is of the essence, they could use something like a depth filter to remove the gross lees or a centrifuge to speed this up. Centrifuges and depth filters, they're expensive bits of equipment, so probably use them just in the very largest wineries. After you've removed the gross lees, the next thing to come out of the wine is the fine lees. And these are any remaining dead cells. Now, this could be removed using sedimentation. That is, let the dead yeast cells slowly float down and build up at the bottom, and then rack the wine off the dead yeast into a clean tank. And when you're making a premium wine, this is quite often how it's done. However, if you're in a high-throughput winery, you might speed this up by using a mixture of depth filters and surface filters with different hole sizes to let different particles through. So filtering, again, is faster than sedimentation. So it just depends on the type of winery you are, whether you want to use sedimentation to help clean up the wine, run it through a depth filter or a surface filter. Surface filters are a little bit like a sieve, and the stuff gets caught on the surface of the sieve, if you like. Whereas depth filters, the wine is pushed through some sort of material like clay, and all the particles get caught up in the clay, but the wine gets pushed through. And that's a depth filter. Depth filters are really good for taking something quite murky and cleaning it up. And surface filters are really good for adding a little bit of polish, just taking out the really small stuff. In fact, when we talk about sterile bottling, we'll see that a surface filter can actually remove things right down to the size of bacteria in the wine. Now, you don't normally think of oak barrels when you're thinking of high volume, inexpensive wines. The low cost of these wines preclude the use of new oak barrels. New oak barrels are expensive. However, oak staves and chips can be used at a much lower cost, and they'll impart their oak flavors like such as toast, vanilla, smoke and clove, as well as still help smooth out any harsh tannins. And as we said earlier, high volume inexpensive wines are usually made fruity by keeping the wine away from oxygen in a protected from oxygen method. Now, these wines don't typically benefit from oxidation post-fermentation. So if you are making a sort of a fruit-driven style and you're keeping it away from oxygen, putting it into an oak barrel will allow a small amount of oxygen to seep in, which staves and chips will not do. So this is actually a benefit for staves and chips. That said, not only are oak staves and chips cheaper than oak barrels, their high surface area means that they impart flavors faster as well. This speeds up the winemaking. In fact, you can hang chips and staves in the fermentation tank, which normally a red wine, you wouldn't do fermentation in a barrel because you want to have some control over punching down or pumping over those skin mass. So normally red wines aren't fermented in a barrel, but you can put staves and chips in your tank while you're doing fermentation. So all of a sudden, not only are you getting the flavors out of the staves and chips much faster, the wine's being protected from oxidation while it's getting this oak influence. It's also starting when fermentation starts. So you'll get an extra 3, 4, 5 days jump on the maturation process by doing it during the fermentation. Now, some producers may use oak barrels. If they do, they're older oak barrels, perhaps on their second, third, or fourth fill. So they're losing some of that initial lots of flavor and tannins that an oak barrel would have. The wines that are put into oak barrels will most likely not be protected from oxygen during the fermentation stage, because protective winemaking and then post-fermentation oxidation is not a great combination. Also, oak barrels need to be cleaned, and the storage space of them and filling and emptying them. There's considerable expense and time and effort and cost if you want to use oak barrels for a high volume inexpensive wine. After you've made the wine and you've done some post-fermentation maturation with oak staves, note that's slightly different from post-fermentation maceration, which is skins in contact, which gives you tannins. Post-fermentation maturation is done with oak, typically. The next step is blending. Blending is an important part of any high-volume, inexpensive wine. Most of the wines are grapes sourced from a number of vineyards, usually in a very large area, and may include different regions. While single varietal wines are common, so is blended grape varieties as well. And blended grape varieties allow the balancing of color, flavor, tannins. While single varieties might have different regions, but they've also got blends of different press fractions, again, to boost color, flavor, and tannins if they're required. So whilst the wine may be all Merlot, that doesn't mean that all the Merlot comes from the same place, or that slightly different winemaking techniques and different press fractions give you different options for blending as well. Now, one thing that's really important about these high-volume, inexpensive red wines is you want consistency. And one way to achieve that is during the bottling process, where stabilization, fining, and sterile filtration are also important. Usually, the time frame to stabilize a wine through gradual sedimentation is too slow. And often, over an extended period of time, of even years, once a wine is bottled, tiny particles can clump together to form particles large enough to come out of solution and create a haze in the wine. I often refer to it personally as protein haze. A lot of it can be proteins. And they will come out of the wine over years. However, you can speed up that process by running something through the wine that will bind to these particles while they're still really super small and can't be seen. We call them fining agents and stop the wine turning hazy over time. Historically, in the old days, egg whites were used as fining agents. Once the fining agent's been put on the wine, it normally sinks through the wine, and as it sinks through the wine, it picks up these tiny particles and binds to them. After the fining agent sunk to the bottom of the wine, you then rack the wine off, leaving the fining agent and those hazy causing particles behind as well, and it speeds up the process of making the wine much more stable. The wine can then be filtered if required to make sure all the fine lees are removed, as we said earlier. And just before bottling, you may do what's called a sterile filter here as well. Now, this uses a surface filter, and what will happen is you'll run the wine through it. It'll have a sieve, if you like, with big holes. Then you'll run it through the next sieve, which has got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller holes. And you'll run it through a rack of different filter sheets until you get to the point where you can actually remove bacteria, yeast, all types of tiny, tiny, tiny particles. And that means that when the wine is bottled, it's absolutely inert. There's no bacteria, nothing live in there. And so the wine will stay bright and fresh for a long period of time. Obviously, just before you put the wine into a bottle, you're going to top up the sulfur dioxide levels as well. Remember, high-volume, inexpensive wines often lack tannins, acidity, and concentration for long-term aging. And if it's made in a protective way, i.e. keeping oxygen away, it'll be fruity, but it's not particularly stable to oxygen in the long term. So things like free sulfur dioxide that can bind up with oxygen and protect the wine is desirable. So just before bottling, you'll make sure your sulfur dioxide levels are at the required level for what you're looking for, and you'll just do a little bit of an adjustment there. What you put the wine into doesn't necessarily have to be a bottle. Certainly, bottles with all types of closures are common. You'll see plastic stoppers, solid cork stoppers, technical corks, which are just made up of ground up bits of cork glued together, and screw caps. You can find high volume, inexpensive wines in bag and box, in plastic bottles. Let's face it, these wines don't stand on ceremony, so they don't need to be in glass bottles with a cork typically. One of the massive advantage high-volume, inexpensive wines have is that they don't need to be bottled at the winery. In fact, it's quite common to ship a container with a big old bladder in the middle of it, filled up with wine, and ship that from, say, Australia all the way to England. By not bottling first, a huge amount of volume and a huge amount of weight is saved, and it significantly decreases the cost of shipping. Then, when the wine turns up at a market, then you can bottle it at your local market as well, significantly decreasing your shipping and your carbon footprint. Now, we mentioned a number of regions that are quite well known for producing high-volume, inexpensive wines earlier. And the first region we're going to have a bit of a look at is the USA. And if you see a red wine labeled as from California, that tends to be a high volume, inexpensive wine. Often these wines are grown in the warm to hot and very dry Central Valley, which, apart from Lodi, receives very, very little cooling ocean breeze. Drought is always a risk in California, and that's managed by drip irrigation. But water prices can be very, very high. Vines are almost always trellised, and full mechanisation is typical, including mechanical harvesting and spraying. Due to the high temperatures and the bright, bright sunlight, vines are often allowed to let the leaves flop and drop over the grapes, protecting them from sunburn. Here, Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot are very popular in California for big, high-volume, inexpensive reds. In Australia, often these wines are labelled as Southeastern Australia, and that is a huge area and covers all wine-producing regions in Eastern Australia. This gives huge options for massively interregional blends, but to be honest, much of the high-volume, inexpensive wines comes from the inland areas made up of South Australia's Riverlands, New South Wales, which produces wines in the Riverina area, and the Murray-Darling, which it shares with Victoria. So the Murray-Darling wine region is actually partly in New South Wales and partly in Victoria. This inland area has no coastal cooling influence and is cooled by the mighty Murray-Darling rivers. Many vines are irrigated to cope with frequent droughts, but with limited water, shortages can still occur. Again, these wines are normally trellised and mechanisation is very, very common. A wine region that's a little bit different but does produce these high-volume, inexpensive red wines is La Mancha. La Mancha is the hot inland continental area of Spain, sort of in the bottom right-hand corner of Spain, if you like. And it's cooled at night by its position on an elevated plateau in the Meseta Central. Rainfall is very limited. Historically, the way to manage the lack of rainfall is to give vines plenty of room to grow on water-retaining soils. That means that irrigation isn't required. This low-density, high vineyard spacing makes trellising expensive. So these wines are typically bush vines, which means, again, hand harvesting in the region is common. Hand harvesting does mean that many wineries do have the option to produce wines via carbonic maceration. So carbonic maceration is not uncommon in Spain. And the bush vines naturally just flop their leaves over the grapes, protecting them from sunburn. And we know that grapes with sunburn, those sunburn areas can give quite bitter tannins to the final wine. So you'd want to avoid that if you can. The last little region we'll look at is Beaujolais. And historically, Beaujolais has been spur-trained bush vines, very similar to La Mancha. But with a moderate continental climate, so the shoots are often tied together above the vine, leaving the grapes more exposed. Given that entry-level AC Beaujolais is made using carbonic maceration, hand-harvesting whole bunches is required, and that's simply a cost of producing the wines. Drought is not a significant risk in Beaujolais, and as such, vine density is much higher than in La Mancha, making trellising more economical, and you're starting to see more vines using trellising. And trellising allows for some mechanisation, obviously not the harvesting of grapes, but it does help for other ways of training the vine and managing the vine. I also mentioned earlier, Puglia in the heel of Italy makes high volume, inexpensive wines, along with Sicily, and also big chunks of Veneto as well. We won't look at those regions in particular, but they also are known for producing that style of wine. Okay, that ends our spotlight looking at high volume, inexpensive wines.